You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, I'm talking with Emmy Dean from Roche. We talk about real-world evidence and demystify it. So stay tuned, and now the music. Today's podcast, we will talk about real-world data, real-world evidence, pragmatic studies, and all these big data buzzwords that are out there and how they actually work together. It will be quite interesting experience. Emmy works in this field for quite some time. I'm working in this field for quite some time, so it was a lot of fun to talk with him about this topic. If you like this podcast, it would be awesome if you could share it with a couple of colleagues. Just send the Effective Statistician link to them. Let them know that they can listen to the podcast through their smartphone app, through the browser, on YouTube, on Spotify, pretty much everywhere where you can listen to a podcast, you can listen to the Effective Statistician. So it would be really, really great if you could share it, because it's for free. I know it helps a lot of people. I get a lot of really, really positive feedback about it. And so please tell colleagues, tell friends about it so that they can benefit from it as well. The podcast is produced in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefits of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the video on demand content library, where there's about 200 videos already, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. The reduced rates for non-higher income countries is just £20 per year, and it's also really only £95 for high income countries, so there's really no financial barrier here. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician. Today, I'm speaking with Emmy from Roche, who has previously worked at Gilead. And today, we are talking about real-world evidence or real-world data, which is a really, really big buzzword. And we want to untangle a little bit what that means, have a couple of different perspectives on real-world evidence, what it means, what the data side of it is, what the methodological side of it is, where it can bring value. We hope you'll get a lot of fun as well as learning from this episode. But first, Emmy, maybe you can introduce yourself first.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So first of all, good morning. This is kind of a big moment for me. So I've been listening to your podcast actually for quite some time. I remember when you first made the post on LinkedIn that you'd started it, and I'd shared this with everybody at university. So it's interesting how this has come full circle. Huge fan.
Awesome. Awesome to have a listener as a as an interview guest. Always very good.
So yeah, I'm a real-world data scientist at Roche. I've been with the company now for just it's actually a year, 1 year and 2 weeks. That's how closely we measure time, you know, keeping it data-driven. I work mainly in the fields of oncology or malignant and non-malignant hematology. Yeah, I've trained, I think as most people really, I got into this by accident. So I started off my career, you know, studying medical science, and I had one lecture where they were showing us, we had this amazing professor who was really showing us just a linear regression model, right? And it was blood pressure, and I'll never forget this, risk of myocardial infarction. And seeing how this, you know, really simple y equals mx plus c, how this is actually used to predict somebody's risk and allow somebody to understand something about these two variables, like applied to medicine, I became hooked. Absolutely became hooked. So went and studied epidemiology, then carried on and did machine learning. And yeah, the rest is history. So yeah, that's a bit about me.
Okay, very good. And you now work a lot on real-world data and real-world evidence, or RWE. What does RWE for you mean, actually?
Yeah, wow. How long do you have?
One episode.
Real-world evidence really is, we need to make a distinction, right? Okay, so let's talk about RWD first. So real-world data. Real-world evidence is something. Yeah. So real-world data really is, for me, is anything that is generated outside outside your traditionally controlled randomized experiment. So for me, this could be a prospective EMR, prospective cohort study, a retrospective cohort study. It could be anything that's anything that comes out of large databases, but also as we were discussing earlier, the idea that from pragmatic trials, right? If you have if you start off with, let's say, a Twix design, a cohort, an observational cohort study that you randomly sample from, I would contest that even though it's a randomized design, this is because it's taking place in the real world, so to speak, then it's from real world data. So I think it's anything that's generated in a normal setting where a patient or where healthcare is delivered under everyday conditions.
Yeah. I think there's some gray areas there as well. Yeah. So if you have these pragmatic studies that where you try to have just the randomization as an intervention and nothing else, then that is already very, very close to real world data, isn't it?
It depends, right? If you're comparing an intervention against standard of care, we have our fabulous new drug and we want to compare it against standard of care, but in really the real world setting, I think if you set up a pragmatic trial where your only intervention, as you said, is the randomization between whether the patient is on the intervention or not, I would contend that this actually forms real world data, or this generates real world data.
Yeah. And I think the amount of real world data is increasing a lot. So we have more and more electronic health records. We have more and more our wearables, everything that, you know, we track our personal health all the time with all kind of different things. And there's more and more these things are connected against each other. I was at the last PSI conference, I was seeing a poster at Scandinavian registries, and where they had all these different databases from that contained demographic data, that contained socioeconomic data, that contained medical data over long, long periods of time. So you know, even lifelong data for lots of people, where you can link them all together and have a very, very holistic data set for nationwide, so to say. These things are more and more becoming the norm, and sometimes also in this kind of big data buzzword area.
Yes, okay. Yeah, it's these huge prospective registries where you have all of this longitudinal information, you know, are incredible. They allow us to really gain, tremendous insights. Not just from, you know, understanding and it's important, right? What the burden of disease is, or what a socioeconomic cost is, but also if we're collecting the right kind of information, we can really start to understand things about the pathology of disease. We can start to use these data sets actually for drug discovery to generate hypotheses. And this is what I was getting at earlier. Like, real world data are these mass data sets or small data sets that we have. But real world evidence is actually turning that into something meaningful. And for me, really, the exciting thing, the real world sort of side of things, is so exciting and so much fun to work in, is the constant need of evolution and thought on methodology.
Yeah.
If you have a real world data set, you can't take anything for granted. I make this this analogy when I'm teaching, is that if the real world data is a book, you know, if you're reading a book, the methodology is the way that you understand the language. And you can take nothing for granted. You really must think through everything from your endpoints, what the actual variables even mean, how the data has been generated. All of these different aspects one must consider and think through very carefully to generate really meaningful evidence.
Yeah, so I think that is a really important point. So first you need to very thoroughly understand how the data is generated, because that's the only way you will understand where biases will come from. So where is this population coming from? Is that only, for example, primary care population, or is that only a specialist population, which will drive kind of, you know, what type of patients you will have in there that are probably not, you know, reflective of the overall population? Or is that from an insurer that is primarily targeting, let's say, lower socioeconomic populations? Or is that from a specific area of the country where there's, you know, maybe a specific industry that drives a lot of different health issues? So I once had a discussion with someone working in pharmacies, and he said, well, he worked in three different pharmacies across Germany, and in each pharmacy there was completely different types of pharmaceuticals sold, because in one area there was, you know, it was really dark and rural and very foggy in the winter, lots of antidepressants. In other areas, there was, you know, a specific type of wine that was very considered, and lots of things that had to do with kind of controlling your stomach. And yet other areas that were completely different. So because there was heavy industry, and then there was much more kind of COPD and respiratory drugs. So knowing where the data is coming from, how it's generated, what are potentially these mechanisms that drive the different biases, is really, really important. Otherwise, you can't frame it in the end. Your answer's correct.
100%. Well, it's honestly, like, I think the most crucial step. One is, if you're fortunate enough to be building a data set, so if you're doing a prospective or retrospective study where you're actually going out to sites and to hospitals, and you're recruiting patients, or you're looking at medical records and abstracting retrospectively, like, thinking about how this data is generated and how it's captured, but more so than that is thinking about, okay, well, is the standard of care that I'm, if I'm looking at a particular disease, am I sure that the sites that I've selected and that the population I'm looking at is representative of the wider population? And is the standard of care really the standard? Am I looking at, let's say, you know, really academic centers that really do, like, interesting experimental things? If I'm thinking of doing something like, you know, for a regulatory submission, like using, you know, a external control arm or something, is this standard of care? Are the ways these patients are monitored? Are the way these patients are treated? Is this really what happens in practice? I don't think we can underscore the importance of understanding how your data is generated and what it means before you do anything else.
Yeah. There's one interesting story where someone looked at some propensity scoring and compared one treatment versus the other, and interestingly, there was one fraction of the population that got a propensity of zero, flat out. Yeah. And what's happening here? You know, why do these patients have 100% probability to get one treatment and 0% probability to get the others?
Okay.
Well, it was contraindicated for the other. Of course, that is a patient population where, you know, any treatment differences doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Knowing that you, in your selection of your observational patients, you restrict it to only those patients where any inferences or where your question of interest is actually applicable is one of these areas to know how the data is generated.
And also, to follow up on that, it's ensuring that the question you want to ask, the question that we ask of the data, is it answerable using the data set you're thinking of, or using the study design the data generation mechanism you're thinking of? So if I want to understand something about the pathology of the disease, if I want to look at the gene, if I want to understand, you know, if I want to investigate why a particular subgroup of patients don't respond well to a drug, I would really want to have a really high, I really call them high resolution data sets, you know, so like an EMR that has genetic profiles of these patients where I can really look at things. You know, using an insurance, doing an analysis on that, using insurance claims data, this really is nonsensical. So really thinking through, you know, this is the question I have. What is the best data source or the best data set that I can use to help me answer that question? Is this data set suited to answering the question? It's probably a more eloquent way of putting it across.
Yeah, but I think it starts even further. It starts even sooner with kind of getting the question really, really correctly phrased at the beginning. Because very often you'll get a question that is maybe very generic, like, what are the patients that best respond to our treatment?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that is actually not a very, very precise question, because are you talking about responding better than standard of care? Are you talking about responding better than placebo? Are you talking about responding at all? So, and depending on, you know, refining that question, that will drive whether you go, for example, in a clinical trial, whether you go in an observational setting, and other things. And also, are you more interested in kind of baseline responders? So before you actually make a treatment decision, or do you think about, okay, we give patients the treatment and then, you know, see throughout the treatment whether we stop it, which is another. Are you interested in to see early indicators that a patient will respond later? Or are you interested in seeing, okay, at which time point is actually, it's very, very unlikely that the patient later will respond. So it's better to stop treatment there. So these are all very, very different questions. However, they're very often kind of lumped up in this question about what are our responders.
Exactly. And this really gets, I don't think, by the way, this is just a problem for us who work in real world data. I know, like many of my colleagues, you know, working clinical trials, are also pulling their hair out when they get this kind of question. Like, what do you mean? I think with any kind of scientific exercise, really getting the question down and ensuring that your understanding of the question is the same as your stakeholders, that your question is, you know, straightforward, simple, and answerable is the key before you think of anything else, right? And also, as you were discussing, you know, who are responders? There's so many different ways one can answer that question. And what the output of that should be. Would you like a comparative effectiveness study where we compare the intervention versus, you know, the standard of care in the real world, and we come up with a treatment effect estimate? Or would you like us to produce a prognostic model? We develop an algorithm that will predict whether a patient's going to be a responder or not, to maybe be used in a clinical decision support system. Do we want to look at comparative safety? As you said, yeah, there's are these patients responders is a little too broad, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so if we think about now, we have a question that would be most suitable for some real-world evidence data. How does then the data set and the methodology for you come in? Is it first the methodology and then the data set, or is it the other way around? How do you think about it?
For me, honestly, the two are so intertwined. Once we, and also, I think really in the real-world sphere, you can't pull one away from the other. They're so intertwined. It's incredible. So I think when once we have a question, and it's you, let's say we have a comparative effectiveness question that we want to use for a regulatory submission. I think the minute we have that already, we're thinking, okay, what kind of methods can we apply? What kind of approaches can we take? Are we thinking here of really trying to match something to a clinical, so using a similar inclusion exclusion criteria to a clinic, to a randomized experiment? And then are we going to do propensity scoring, or shall we use instrumental variable analysis? So already these questions are coming into your mind. Then when you're looking at the data sets, you know, for me, before I do anything, like step one is after, you know, understanding the data generation mechanism, etc., is really creating the table one. I think there is nothing more useful in the life as a statistician than a table one, your subject disposition table. This really gives you, like, it's a, if this was a book, this would be, you know, the introductory chapter, right? This is your population. And they look at that and you try to understand, you try to really start to see if you can spot anything.
So disposition, including baseline characteristics. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Baseline characteristics, lab values. And really for me, I have, I think everybody has their own little obsession in the world of stats. For me, really, I love missing data methodology. So really looking at, and this is something that always my colleague, that some colleagues are quite uncomfortable with, you know, in the clinic, in the interventional setting, a patient, you know, the missing data is seen as really not much of a problem. Patients tend to turn up when they're supposed to turn up most of the time. Well, in the real world, things are a little bit more complex. So really starting to think about all of these different aspects. Sometimes I remember a couple of years ago, I had a study where I was using multiple imputation and propensity scoring, and there was actually very little in the literature about which way you should really do this. So I ended up trying maybe three or four different methods and then doing some sensitivity analysis. But I think that really is the beauty of real-world data. Like, once you get into the question, like, it is so much fun. Like, you... It's great.
In terms of missing data, I think what we need to highlight here is at the moment we are just speaking about missing data at baseline. Yep. When you hear about missing data in the context of clinical trials, we often speak about missing data that happens later on in the study because patients drop out, because patients switch treatment or, you know, discontinue whatsoever. But here it already starts that you have big sets of data that are missing at baseline. So, and I know exactly that these can be quite influential. I once was working on a study in schizophrenia where we were looking into drug abuse at baseline, and it was basically yes, no, or missing. And guess what? Those with missing had the worst prediction.
It's always the way.
Yeah. So missing doesn't mean, you know, necessarily that it's missing at random. Very often it's very informative missing. And so sometimes you can even then treat this missing category as its own category. So, yeah, and that's what we ended up doing in the end. We said, yes, no, unknown. And unknown was really kind of also something that people can relate to. The psychiatrist that I was working with, yeah, I think we know what kind of people these are. That will not answer anything.
So missing at baseline is really at times something one really must consider. And that's where the old maxim that, you know, you try to deal, you know, if you really try to deal with the potential issues in your study at the design level. So then you have to reduce your potential headaches at the analytical level. Sometimes you see in protocols, for example, patients must have X, Y, and Z variable. But also sometimes at baseline, you do find missing data, but also in the follow-up as well. How do you deal with it? And for me, I'm always a little surprised when you see missing data is taken as it's almost a secondary consideration, right? And I think the thing that I think that keeps us all awake at night is really trying to reduce the amount of bias and confounding in any kind of inference. You know, our results or our work can really impact what happens to the patient's bedside, can really impact whether a drug is developed or not, whether we go into a new disease area or not. And everything we do reduces is tailored to get the most accurate estimate possible. Well, keeping, you know, not dealing with missing data properly, this, you know, throws mountains of bias and confounding in your results, really questions everything. And the methodologies are nothing new, you know. They're just, you know, amazing papers out there really explaining this methodology quite well. How even now we have these software packages. It's not like in the old days, you know, we have whether it's SAS or R or state. It's so easy. It's so easy to implement. The level of computing power is, again, it really baffles me when we leave missing data as a secondary consideration in our design or in our analyses.
Actually, I think that is also where really the fun of the statisticians comes in. So the, yeah. as you say, you know, in lots of these retrospective sets, there's only so much you can do in your kind of protocol. You know, the data is as it is, and you can not design it differently. You can't influence it a lot. You need to spend much more brain power to make sense out of it. There's, however, one thing that you said about the confounding and bias. Yes, I completely agree. We need to understand biases and confounding, but I'm not sure we always need to reduce it for at any price, because my perception is we should always be careful about this variance bias trade-off. Yeah. So you can reduce bias so much that in the end you have huge confidence intervals and you can't claim anything anymore. So sometimes I think being a little bit off target, knowing somehow how much you're off target, but then at least being precise is better than being exactly on bull's eye, yeah. but you know, never even hitting the plate. So
they end up asking, you know, so is the drug effective? Yes or no? I'm definitely correct, but yes, it's somewhere between yes and no. I'm not sure. No, I completely agree. Yep. Yeah, 100%.
Okay, so in terms of now we have the question, how do you find out about what is the right data set to have the right question? What are the approaches you take?
For me, it all depends on what we're using it for and what the question is.
But where do you find these data sets? Do you predominantly look in for in-house data sets, or what's your approach?
For me, to find a real-world data asset, a real-world data set, again, it really depends. So I think for me, step one is I do what's called the data landscaping, you know, which is as close to a systematic literature review that you can get. So really start to do a really thorough literature review, looking for anybody who's published absolutely anything on the subject I'm looking at, where they've used a cohort study or an EMR or a claims data set or anything, and really see what's been done already. Mm-hmm. Then you sort of look at the data sets there and you see the variables they've collected. And you think about, again, that data capture mechanism, how old the data set is the data of the resolution that one would need to answer, you know, the question then they have, then you make a determination. Can I use this data that's already out there again? So do I use a secondary data analysis? Or do I need to do my own? Do I need to generate my own data? So do I need to go recruit patients? Do I need to go and, you know, go to different sites and extract through an EMR? But also now we have some really nice in-house assets as well. So really, one has like, you know, a universe of different sources, and you investigate them and think. And there's always trade-offs, right? You will always get the variables you want in the way you want if you do your own study.
Yeah.
If you collect your own data. Oh my God, it's incredible. You can set up your own ECRF. You're in really close contact with the sites.
But it costs 10 million and you need 5 years.
So, you know, just a slight trade-off. You know, what's 10 years in the context of a fund? But no, exactly. But then if you have if you're using somebody else's data set, you have what you have. And again, sometimes that's absolutely fine. And sometimes that's more than enough. You know, the amount of comparative safety I've done in Market Scan or Pharmetrics Plus, these huge commercial claims data sets, where they've been really informative and really helpful and actually, you know, impacted patient care, have been superb. And you know, there's no need for answering a question at a pharmacovigilance level to really do these big studies. But other times it's important. And it comes down to what is the trade-off, what's the use, and is the data set appropriate? And there's so many different aspects you have to answer and think about when you're choosing one or trying to find one.
Yeah, I think that is a big difference between if you predominantly work in clinical trials and whether you work on these real-world data side. Because in the clinical trials, you basically know all the data set that's relevant for you. You that's your study or the study within your team. You know, there's only so many studies on your new compound, and they are all run by your company or by maybe partner companies that you're working together with. However, if you look into this real world data topic, you will have lots of different opportunities to look into data, into internal data, external data, work into collaboration with government bodies, with academic bodies. And all these come with their different methodological and data intrinsic strengths and limitations, but also practical things. Yeah, so are there for certain data sets, is there certain procedures that you need to go through to make sure that data privacy is kept? Or is that a data set that is owned by a certain key opinion leader that you just need to have a good relationship with? Or is that something that you readily have access through your internal resources? So all these practical things, I think, play a big role in our day-to-day life as well.
Yeah, 100%. Having those collaborations with academic institutions and key researchers is essential. Ensuring 100%. That the patient privacy and that we maintain that patient privacy and we ensure that everything is compliant is incredibly important. Is fundamentally important to the work we do. But just a point that I think we all share with my colleagues, actually. We were speaking about this the other day, and I think, in real-world data, a patient has given you, has consented to you having access to what is effectively, the most personal data anyone can share, the medical record, And they do this mostly altruistically. They say, listen, here is my data, here's my information, use this for research. We think genuinely that, as a statistician, as a data scientist, you have an absolute responsibility to ensure that you get the most appropriate insights from this data possible to really drive an innovation and drug development in that field. So this is why I think, really in real-world data, that this huge focus on methodology really is there, because you want to ensure that you can understand what you're seeing as clearly as possible.
Yeah. The other nice thing about it, if you have these publicly available data sets, everything becomes much more transparent, because it's, everybody can access this data set. Everybody can have the same approaches as you do and basically rerun your analysis or tweak it. So I think that is actually a very, very nice way to be much more transparent, much more, generate more trust through that, and actually learn from others, because you see what's, you can replicate things much easier.
Definitely, I think this is really something that's really fantastic in the real world community. Actually, if one looks at many of the papers published or many of the studies published, some of the things I'm seeing now are people even uploading like IPython notebooks or scripts up, so you can actually go and interrogate and see like, oh, how did you build that model? Oh, I see an assumption here. I want to see if I can change this around. And honestly, you become so much more engaged in each other's research. And at the end of the day, we as scientists, I think usually you have to be open to that, right? It's the only way that our methodology becomes better, and we validate we validate the insights we're generating. Agree.
Yeah, I think that's where we should get to, and maybe that's an area where the clinical trials can actually learn from in terms of transparency. And maybe that is the future, especially with these initiatives where you can request data, clinical study request, I think .com, how is it called? And maybe in the future you can even request the specific analysis and the programs from there, so that it becomes more transparent. So
As a kind of final question, and to sum it up a little bit, what makes, you know, what are kind of for you aspects that make really good real world evidence?
What are some aspects? So for me, I love the, so I absolutely love my discipline. Like I'm the guy who looks forward to Monday morning.
That's where we all want to be, isn't it?
So for me, like where I really get energized from in real world evidence is I don't ever think that real world evidence and is yeah. ever going to replace the RCT. I don't think that's how they complement and augment each other incredibly well. I love it, or I get very energized when you are able to allow a drug to get to market faster. So to really deliver that benefit to a patient population. So if that's being able to run a single arm study where you have a real world data control arm, if it's appropriate. You know, if it meets certain requirements, etc., and statistically and methodologically and scientifically and medically, it makes sense doing that and really speeding up drug development. I think is superb. I think it's fantastic when you're able to use real world evidence to really learn something novel about a disease. I think that's really, really good fun, especially now with these clinical genomic data sets. I think that's really an exciting field. Also, for me, is really being able to work on regulatory aspects, whether that's, you know, looking at comparative effectiveness and safety in the real world. And I think the beauty of this field is really almost every... even though epidemiology, so I think real world evidence is really built on epidemiology, which is the backbone of evidence based medicine. I think now it's really developed now where it's in this interesting place where if you think of a Venn diagram between statistics biostats, epi, and computer science with the machine learning, I think that's really where we are somewhere. I think almost every month we're thinking of new ways where RWD and RWE can really bring value to the work we do. But yeah, I think this is we're really at an interesting stage. I think with the amounts of high resolution data we're generating, I think we're really going to be able to bring incredible insights and really support and hopefully, you know, further drive drug developments to get, you know, therapeutics to patients quicker, faster, and cheaper.
Yeah. That is a really, really nice summary, because real-world evidence is then something of high value if it drives high-value decision-making. And if it enables things to go, yeah, as you say, faster, make patients benefit more from treatments, and understand the diseases better. Thanks so much for your passionate discussion.
Thank you so much for the podcast. As I said, really, I'm honest to God, an avid listener. I'm a huge fan. So yeah, this is, you know, if after this, maybe you need to send me an autograph or something.
and off the record, that wasn't triggered. I didn't know that you would speak so highly about the podcast during this interview. So thanks so much for the feedback. That really makes my day.
No, absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain, who helped with the show in the background and makes it so much more easier for me. Thank you for listening. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statistician in the health sector. And please tell your colleagues about it. It means so much to me, and it will surely help them as this podcast helps you and lots of your peers already. We have hundreds of downloads now per week, so it's proof too that there's a lot of helpful material in here, and it helps people to better work, to more effectively work. So your colleagues will surely benefit from that as well. So, as always, I'm ending with reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.